Clara Whitmore pressed her dead father's ledger against her chest, like it was the only thing keeping her heart from falling out. Her hands were steady. Her jaw was set. She had not eaten since yesterday, and her gray dress had been mended twice at the hem, but she walked through those ballroom doors like she had every right in the world to be standing there, because she did. Because her father died finding the truth inside that room, and she was not leaving without it. If this story moves you, subscribe and follow every part to the end. Drop your city in the comments. I want to see how far this story travels. The Bellamy Assembly Hall was the kind of place that made ordinary people feel like a mistake. The chandeliers threw gold light across silk gowns and polished boots. The air smelled of expensive perfume and beeswax candles. Every man in attendance had a name that meant something in Boston. Every woman on his arm had been trained since childhood to smile at the right moment, to laugh at the right volume, and to look past anyone who did not belong. Clara Whitmore belonged to none of that world, and every single person in that hall knew it the moment she stepped through the door. She was 24 years old. Her father had been dead for 6 weeks. The gray dress she wore was clean but not fashionable, pressed but not elegant. She carried no fan, no jeweled brooch, no dancing card. She carried a leather ledger worn at the corners, with her father's handwriting pressed into its pages like a second heartbeat. The whispers started before she reached the second step. Is that the clerk's daughter? I thought she was in mourning. Who on earth invited her? Clara heard every word. She kept walking. She had practiced this walk in the narrow hallway of her rented room on Archer Street for 3 nights straight. She had told herself that the distance from the front door to the east window was 22 steps, and that she could survive 22 steps no matter what anyone said. Her father had survived far worse for far longer, and he had done it quietly without flinching, because he believed the truth was worth whatever discomfort it cost to carry it. She made it to the 14th step before Beatrice Montgomery stepped directly into her path. Beatrice was everything Clara was not, at least by Boston's reckoning. She was 26, polished and beautiful, in the particular way that money and leisure could manufacture over a lifetime. Her gown was deep ivory silk with gold trim. Her dark hair was pinned with a pearl comb. She smiled when she looked at Clara, but the smile did not reach her eyes. It never did. My goodness, Beatrice said loud enough for the nearest cluster of guests to hear. Did someone forget to lock the kitchen entrance this evening? Soft laughter moved through the crowd, like a ripple across still water. Clara stopped walking. She looked at Beatrice directly without blinking, and she said nothing for a long moment. Beatrice tilted her head. You really ought not to be here, Miss Whitmore. This is a private gathering. It requires an invitation. I have one, Clara said. Beatrice's smile flickered. From whom? From Margaret Bellamy. Whose hall this happens to be? The flicker disappeared behind something colder. Beatrice stepped aside. But she did it slowly, deliberately, making it clear that the movement was a concession she found distasteful. Several women nearby exchanged glances. One of the older men near the fireplace said something behind his hand, and his companion chuckled. Clara finished her 22 steps and reached the east window. She opened the ledger. She needed two things tonight. She needed to find the page her father had flagged with a strip of red ribbon before he died. And she needed to find Widow Margaret Bellamy, who had sent the invitation 3 days ago, with a note that read only, Your father trusted me with something. Come to the ball. Bring the ledger. Tell no one. Clara had told no one. She had also barely slept. The red ribbon was on page 47. Her father's handwriting filled the margins in cramped, careful script columns of land valuations, revenue figures, dates, and names. Three of the names were crossed out and rewritten in a different ink. One name appeared 11 times across 6 separate pages. Silas Montgomery. Clara did not look up from the ledger when she heard footsteps approach. She assumed it was Beatrice returning with reinforcements, or perhaps one of the hall's attendants, about to politely ask her to leave. She was already composing her response in her mind, something calm and firm and legally grounded, when a man's voice spoke instead. That's a county revenue ledger. Clara looked up. He was tall with dark hair that needed cutting and a coat that was well made but not showy. His face was serious, not unkind, but not particularly warm either. He looked like a man who spent most of his time thinking about problems rather than attending social events. And he looked faintly irritated to be at this one. "Yes," Clara said. "It is. Those ledgers are county property. They're held at the records office. This one was in my father's desk when he died," Clara said. "He was the county clerk for 11 years. He had legal custody of it." The man studied her face. "And who was your father?" "Edmund Whitmore." She watched his expression carefully. "He died 6 weeks ago. The county listed the cause as fever." Something shifted behind his eyes. "I heard about that." "Most people did," Clara said. "Fever is a tidy explanation." He was quiet for a moment. Then he said, "What do you mean by that?" "I mean that my father was in perfect health on a Tuesday. By Thursday he was dead. And the last thing he wrote in his private journal was the name Silas Montgomery and the words, 'They know I found it.'" The man looked at the ledger in her hands. Then he looked across the room toward where Silas Montgomery stood near the fireplace, silver-haired and smiling, surrounded by aldermen and businessmen who laughed at his jokes. "My name is Jonathan Ashford," the man said quietly. Clara knew the name. Everyone in Massachusetts with any connection to land records or county finance knew the name. The Ashford family had been one of the largest landholders in the state for three generations. 2 years ago, the estate had suffered significant losses that no one had ever satisfactorily explained. "I know who you are," Clara said. "Then you may also know that my family lost approximately $40,000 in land revenue over an 8-year period," Jonathan said. "Revenue that should have come from tenant leases on our eastern parcels. Revenue that simply vanished." "It didn't vanish," Clara said. She turned to page 47 and held the ledger so he could see the columns. "It was redirected. Look at these transfer notations. These three names listed as tenant holders, Aldrich, Pell, and Farrow, they don't exist. I checked every county registration in the Eastern District. There are no property holders with those surnames. They're shell names. Someone created them to move revenue off the official record and into a separate account." Jonathan stared at this page. His jaw tightened. He said nothing for a long moment. "And those accounts connect to Montgomery?" he finally asked. "They connect to a land-holding company called the Harwick Land Trust," Clara said, "which was registered in 1811 under a proxy name. But the founding documents list a silent partner whose initials are S.A.M. She turned to page 62. "Silas Archibald Montgomery." The room around them had gone somewhat quieter. Clara noticed it without turning her head. Several people nearby had stopped their conversations and were watching her and Jonathan with poorly concealed curiosity. Jonathan noticed it too. He straightened and turned so that his body partially blocked the ledger from the rest of the room's view. "How long have you known this?" he asked quietly. "I found the ledger the night my father died," Clara said. "I've spent 6 weeks cross-referencing it against every public county record I could access. The clerk's office doesn't restrict public access to historical revenue filings. I went every morning before the office opened to regular business." "And Margaret Bellamy? How does she fit into this?" "She knew my father for 20 years. She came to his funeral, and she held my hand, and she said nothing except, 'He was a good man, and good men deserve better than what happened to him.' 3 days ago, she sent me the invitation and the note." Clara paused. "I think she's been waiting for someone to come forward. I think she may know more than I do." Jonathan looked across the room toward the far end of the hall, where Widow Bellamy stood, in a black gown, near the doors to the garden, a glass of wine in one hand, and the steady, watchful eyes of a woman who had spent 50 years learning how to read a room without appearing to look at anything. "She's watching us right now," Jonathan said. "She has been since I walked in," Clara said. Jonathan turned back to Clara. His expression had changed, less guarded now, more focused. He looked at her the way she imagined he looked at a legal brief, or a survey map with the particular attention of a man trying to understand not just what something said, but what it meant. "Miss Whitmore," he said, "what exactly do you want to do with this?" "I want to correct the county record," Clara said. "I want my father's name on the official document as the man who first identified this fraud. And I want Silas Montgomery charged under the county revenue statutes." "That's not a small thing." "No," Clara said. "It isn't. Montgomery has 3 aldermen in his social circle and a personal friendship with Judge Harlan Wickes," Jonathan said. "Any legal proceeding against him will be heard by Wickes, who has had dinner at Montgomery's home at least 12 times in the last 2 years." "I know," Clara said. "That's a problem we'll need to solve." Jonathan looked at her for a long moment. Then unexpectedly, he almost smiled. It wasn't warm exactly, but it was something close to respect. "You said we," he said. "You lost $40,000, Clara said. "Your family has legal standing that I don't have as a private citizen. I have the evidence and the knowledge. You have the standing and the resources." She met his eyes steadily. "I reckon that makes us useful to each other, Mr. Ashford." Across the room, Silas Montgomery had stopped laughing at someone's joke. His eyes had found Clara and Jonathan at the east window. His expression had not changed, but something behind it had gone very still. Beatrice appeared at his shoulder. She leaned close and said something. Silas's jaw tightened almost imperceptibly. Margaret Bellamy set down her wine glass and began moving toward Clara through the crowd, with the unhurried precision of a woman who had been waiting for this moment for a very long time. "Miss Whitmore," Jonathan said quietly, "I need you to understand something before this goes further. If we move against Montgomery, and we are wrong about even one piece of this, or if the evidence doesn't hold..." "It holds," Clara said. "I need you to be certain, Mr. Ashford." Clara closed the ledger. Her voice was quiet and absolutely steady. "My father spent 11 years in that records office. He taught me to read a revenue ledger before I was 12 years old. He showed me what honest bookkeeping looks like, and he showed me what dishonest bookkeeping tries to look like when someone's trying to hide it." She looked down at the worn leather cover in her hands. "He died 6 weeks ago because he found proof of what I am holding right now. I am certain." Jonathan looked at the ledger. He looked at her face. He nodded once, slowly. "All right," he said. Margaret Bellamy reached them then, appearing at Clara's left side with the quiet efficiency of someone who had navigated difficult rooms for decades. "I see you've met Mr. Ashford," she said to Clara, as if they were simply exchanging pleasantries at a garden party. "We've just been introduced," Clara said. "Good." Margaret's voice was low and even. "Then I'll say what I should have said at your father's funeral, except that there were too many of the wrong people listening." She looked at Clara directly. "Edmund Whitmore came to me 8 months before he died. He told me what he'd found. I told him to document everything and to trust no one inside the county administration. He followed that advice." She paused. "He also told me that if something happened to him, I should watch for you." Clara's throat tightened. "He knew. He suspected," Margaret said gently. "He was a careful man. He hoped he was wrong." She looked at Jonathan. "Mr. Ashford, your family's losses are part of this record. I believe you know that."
"I'm beginning to understand it," Jonathan said.
"Then the three of us have a great deal to discuss," Margaret said. "Not here. Tomorrow morning before the records office opens. I have a private arrangement with the clerk on duty, an old acquaintance who owes Edmund Whitmore more than he can easily repay." She pressed something into Clara's hand. A small card with an address. 7 o'clock. Don't be followed." Across the hall, Silas Montgomery set down his glass. He said something brief to the alderman beside him, and the alderman nodded and moved away. Silas turned and walked toward the hall's side entrance without hurrying, without looking back. But Beatrice stayed. She stood near the fireplace and watched Clara with an expression that had stopped being dismissive and become something harder. Clara looked back at her without flinching. The ballroom's noise filled the space between them. Laughter music, the scrape of dancing shoes on polished floor.
All of it felt very distant to Clara just then. She was aware only of the ledger in her hands, her father's handwriting on those pages, and the particular weight of a truth that had been waiting 6 weeks for someone brave enough to carry it into a room full of people who did not want to hear it. She had carried it in. She was not setting it down. Margaret touched her arm briefly. "Go home tonight by the back lane," she said quietly. "Take nothing valuable with you that you cannot afford to lose." "I'm not afraid," Clara said. "I know you aren't," Margaret said, "but be careful anyway. Fear and caution are not the same thing, and your father understood that distinction better than most." Jonathan fell into step beside Clara as she moved toward the exit, not offering his arm, not making a show of it, simply walking alongside her, the way a man walks beside someone he has decided to take seriously. He said nothing until they reached the hallway. "That address she gave you," he said. "I know the building. The county archive room is on the second floor. It holds records going back to 1801. "I know," Clara said. "My father worked there every Tuesday for 8 years. Jonathan pushed open the outer door. The summer night air was warm and thick, with the smell of horse and grass and the distant river. Clara stepped through and stopped on the top step, the ledger still pressed against her chest. She thought about her father at his desk by lamplight, squinting at columns of numbers, muttering under his breath when something didn't fit. She thought about the way he would tap his finger on the page and say, "Clara girl, when a number lies, it always lies somewhere you're not supposed to look. That's how you find it." "Miss Whitmore," Jonathan said beside her. "Are you all right?" "Yes," she said. It was true enough. She was grieving and exhausted and quietly terrified, but she was also something else, something that had no tidy name, but felt like the first step of a very long road she had already decided to walk. She tucked the ledger more firmly under her arm. 7 o'clock tomorrow," she said. "I'll be there," Jonathan said. She walked down the steps and into the summer dark, and she did not look back at the lights of the Bellamy Assembly Hall, and she did not think about Beatrice Montgomery's cold eyes or the way the room had laughed at her dress. She thought about page 47 and the name that appeared 11 times and the strip of red ribbon her father had placed there with his own hands in the last days of his life, as if he had known she would need to find it. "She thought, I found it, Papa. I've got it." And she kept walking. Clara did not sleep that night. She sat at the small table by her window on Archer Street, with the ledger open in front of her and a candle burned down to its last inch, and she went through every page again from the beginning. Not because she doubted what she had found. She doubted nothing. She went through it again because she needed to know it the way she knew her own name, not just intellectually, not just logically, but in her bones, in the muscles of her hands, in the part of her mind that did not panic under pressure. Her father had taught her that. "Know your evidence better than your enemy knows his lies. A liar has to remember what he said. You only have to remember what is true." By the time the sky outside her window began to lighten from black to the deep blue-gray of very early morning, she had memorized every altered entry, every false name, every suspicious transfer notation, and every date on which a discrepancy appeared. She had also made a clean copy in her own handwriting on fresh paper, because she had decided the night before that she was not walking into that archive room with only one copy of anything. She folded the copy into the lining of her coat. She wrapped the original ledger in a piece of oilskin cloth and tied it with cord. She drank a cup of cold water because there was no time to heat anything, pinned her hair without looking in the mirror, and walked out into the summer morning before 6 o'clock. She took the back lane as Margaret had told her. She also took a route that added 10 minutes to the journey, doubling back twice, stopping once to pretend she was adjusting her boot while she watched the street behind her. Her father had taught her that too, though she had never imagined she would actually need it. She had thought of it as an old man's caution, the habit of someone who had worked around powerful people for too long and begun to see threats in ordinary shadows. She did not think of it that way anymore. The building on Merchant's Court was 3 stories of old brick with a narrow door and no sign. Jonathan Ashford was already standing outside when she arrived. His coat was plain, and his hat was pulled low, and he looked like a man who had also not slept, though he carried it differently than she did, less like exhaustion, and more like a long-standing familiarity with difficulty. "You came alone?" he asked. "Yes." "You?" "Yes." They went inside without another word. Margaret Bellamy was already upstairs in the archive room, sitting at the head of a long table with a lamp lit and three separate stacks of documents arranged in front of her with the precision of a woman who had done this before. The room smelled of old paper and dust, and the faint mineral smell of ink that had been drying on pages for decades. "Close the door," Margaret said without looking up. "Lock it." Jonathan locked it. He and Clara sat down across from Margaret, and for a moment no one spoke. The only sound was the distant noise of the street below beginning to come alive with the first cart horses and early tradesmen of the morning. Then Margaret pushed the largest stack of documents toward the center of the table and said, "Your father gave these to me in October of last year. He said he needed them somewhere safe that was not his office and not his home. I have been sitting on them for 6 months waiting." Clara looked at the stack. Her throat tightened. She recognized her father's organizational system papers, grouped by date, each group separated by a strip of folded paper with a notation in his handwriting. "He knew someone might come for them," Clara said. "He believed it was a possibility he could not ignore," Margaret said. "He also told me that if he died before he could file a formal complaint, the evidence would mean nothing without someone who could read it the way he could. He said the only other person he trusted with the numbers was you." Clara pressed her lips together and looked down at the table. She breathed. "All right," she said after a moment. "Let's read it." What they found in the next 2 hours was worse than Clara had calculated. The altered entries in the county ledger were only the surface. Beneath them, in the documents her father had collected and hidden with Margaret, was a complete secondary record, a shadow bookkeeping system that Silas Montgomery had been running alongside the official county accounts for nearly a decade. It was meticulous, detailed, and damning. Transfer orders signed with a proxy name. Revenue receipts redirected through the Harwick Land Trust. Tenant lease payments collected from real farming families and recorded officially as losses, while the actual cash moved through a series of accounts in Providence and then disappeared into what her father had labeled in careful red ink destination, unconfirmed. Jonathan sat very still while Clara walked him through it.
"He was collecting twice," Jonathan said flatly. "He was collecting the lease revenue from the tenants, recording it as uncollected debt in the county books, and pocketing the difference."
"For 8 years," Clara said. "Across 14 separate properties, 7 of which were in your family's Eastern District." Jonathan said nothing for a moment. When he spoke again, his voice was controlled but tight. "That is my family's money. That is 8 years of revenue that should have funded the estate, paid wages, maintained property." He stopped. "My father died believing the estate was failing because of his mismanagement. He died thinking he had failed 3 generations of family." He paused. "He died thinking that." The silence that followed that sentence was heavy enough to press against the walls. Margaret spoke quietly.
"Jonathan, I am sorry."
"Don't be sorry," he said. His jaw was set.
"Help me stop him."
Clara was already moving to the next group of documents.
"There's something else," she said. "Look at this. These are the proxy signatures on the transfer orders. There are 11 of them across 3 years. They all use the name Henry Aldrich, one of the shell names from the ledger. But look at the handwriting." She spread 3 documents side by side on the table. Jonathan leaned forward.
"It's the same hand," he said.
"Yes, and it isn't Montgomery's. His signature appears on other documents here. I can compare the letter forms. Whoever signed as Henry Aldrich is someone else. Someone inside the county administration who had access to the transfer authorization system."
Clara tapped the documents. "This fraud didn't run itself. Montgomery had help from inside." Margaret's eyes sharpened.
"Do you have any idea who?"
"Not yet," Clara said. "But the handwriting is distinctive enough that if we can find the right comparison documents, we can identify the person." She looked at Jonathan. "The county clerk's office keeps employment records correct.
signature samples on file for all authorized signatories.
They do, Jonathan said. I've seen the process. Any county official with authorization to sign transfer orders has to submit a signature sample when they're appointed.
Then those records will identify the second person, Clara said. That's what I need access to next.
She was reaching for her notes when the sound came. A single deliberate knock at the archive room door. All three of them went still.
Margaret rose without hurrying and moved to the door.
Who is it?
Thomas Wren, ma'am.
A man's voice slightly muffled by the wood.
I'm the morning clerk. I was told you had an authorized early access arrangement.
Margaret looked at Jonathan.
Jonathan gave a small nod. He knew the name, apparently. But Clara's hand had gone to the ledger in front of her. Something felt wrong. The knock had come too precisely, too quietly, like someone who was listening for a response rather than simply announcing themselves.
One moment, Margaret said.
She turned to Clara and spoke very low.
Is there anything on that table that should not be seen?
All of it, Clara said equally low.
They had the documents in their hands, and off the table in under 30 seconds, Clara took her father's papers. Jonathan took the comparison documents, and Margaret swept the remaining folders under her arm with the efficiency of someone who had hidden things under pressure before.
Clara pressed her stack flat against her chest underneath her coat and held it there with one arm.
Margaret unlocked the door. Thomas Wren was young, perhaps 20, with a round face and ink-stained fingers and the look of someone who was deeply uncomfortable. He held a piece of folded paper in his hands and did not step into the room.
I'm terribly sorry to disturb you, Mrs. Bellamy, he said. I was given this morning by a man outside the building. He said it was urgent and that it was intended for one of your guests.
Margaret took the paper without expression. She unfolded it, read it, and passed it to Clara without changing her face.
Clara read it. The note had no signature. It said, "The ledger is county property. Its removal is theft. Return it to the records office by noon, or the matter will be referred to the county magistrate. You have been warned."
Clara folded the note and put it in her pocket. She looked at Wren.
When was this delivered?
Perhaps 15 minutes ago, ma'am.
And the man who delivered it, did he say who he was?
Wren hesitated.
He didn't give a name, but he...
The young man stopped.
What did he look like?
Clara asked.
Wren glanced at the door behind him, then back at Clara.
He looked very young and very nervous.
He was well-dressed, ma'am, silver hair. He had a gold watch on a chain, and he spoke like someone used to being listened to.
Another hesitation.
He also said he said to tell whoever received it that it was a courtesy, that next time there would not be a note.
Clara did not react. She thanked Wren. She waited until he had retreated down the stairs. Then she turned back to Jonathan and Margaret.
He knows we're here, she said. He knew last night, Jonathan said. The moment you walked into that ball and opened that ledger, he knew.
Then we don't have as much time as I thought, Clara said.
We need the employment records. We need the signature comparison. And we need to find the courier.
She turned to Margaret.
My father wrote something in his journal about a courier, Thomas Mercer, a man who made transfers between county offices.
Did you know him?
Margaret's expression shifted slightly.
I knew of him. He died 3 years ago. A riding accident, they said.
Of course they did, Clara said.
Did he have family?
A daughter, Margaret said slowly. Ruth Mercer. She lives in Providence now, I believe. She was about 16 when her father died.
Clara looked at Jonathan. The document chain between the county office and the Providence accounts would have moved through a courier. If Mercer was that courier, he may have kept copies.
People who carry dangerous things sometimes do not to protect themselves necessarily. Sometimes just because they understood what they were carrying.
And his daughter may have them, Jonathan said.
She may not even know what they are, Clara said.
But if they exist, we need them before Montgomery's people find them first. She picked up her coat.
How far is Providence?
2 days by horse, Jonathan said.
1.5 if the roads are good and we don't stop unnecessarily.
He looked at her steadily.
You're proposing we go now?
I'm proposing we go today,
Clara said. This morning, if possible. We leave someone we trust with the documents we already have.
She looked at Margaret. I've kept them safe for 6 months, Margaret said simply. I can keep them safe a little longer.
I need to go home first, Clara said. I need an hour.
You have it, Jonathan said. I'll arrange horses. Meet me at the east side of the common at 8:30.
Clara nodded and moved toward the door.
Jonathan spoke again behind her. Miss Whitmore. She turned. He was looking at her with an expression she hadn't seen on him before. Not quite concern. Not quite something else.
Are you certain you want to do this?
Providence is 2 days' travel, and we do not know what we'll find. And Montgomery already knows who you are and what you're carrying.
Clara looked at him.
Mr. Ashford, my father sat in that records office for 11 years. He did everything carefully and quietly and correctly, and it still got him killed.
She put her hand on the door handle. I am not going to be careful and quiet and wait for justice to find me. I am going to find it myself.
She left before he could answer. She was back on Archer Street in 20 minutes, moving through her small room with deliberate speed, changing her dress for something more practical. Packing a single bag with clean linen and her copy of the evidence and the oilskin-wrapped ledger, eating 4 bites of bread because she knew she needed to tucking her father's journal into the inside pocket of her coat where it sat against her ribs like a second heartbeat. She was almost ready when she heard the footsteps on the stairs outside her door. They were too slow for her landlady, Mrs. Holt. Too heavy for any of the other boarders. Clara stood very still in the center of her room. She looked at the bag in her hand and the door in front of her, and she calculated the distance, the time, the options. The footsteps stopped outside her door. Silence. Then a voice, male, flat, professional, like a man reading from a list rather than speaking to a human being. Miss Whitmore, Mr. Montgomery requests that you make yourself available to speak with his representative today at noon. It is a matter of some legal urgency.
Clara said nothing.
Miss Whitmore, we know you're inside. She walked to the window. Her room was on the second floor. The drop to the back alley below was perhaps 12 feet onto packed dirt. She had done worse. She had never done it on purpose with a bag and a ledger, but she had done worse. She opened the window as quietly as she could.
Miss Whitmore.
She went out the window. She caught the sill dropped as far as she could with her arms fully extended. Let go. The landing jarred through her knees, and she stumbled forward. One step, caught herself, straightened and started walking before anyone above had time to react. She heard the door to her room open. She heard a voice say something sharp. She turned the corner of the alley and did not look back. She reached the east side of the common at 8:20, slightly out of breath and with a bruise forming on her left knee, and Jonathan Ashford was already there with 2 horses. He looked at her face, and then at her bag, and then at the way she was favoring her left leg slightly.
What happened? He said.
Montgomery sent someone to my room, she said. I left through the window.
He stared at her for a moment.
You left through the you're on the second floor.
I am aware of that.
He looked at her leg.
Are you hurt?
I'm fine, she said.
Which horse is mine?
He pointed. She went to it, checked the saddle, adjusted the stirrup, and mounted. She had not ridden in 2 years, but her body remembered it, the weight, the balance, the particular way you had to commit your whole body to the movement, rather than just sitting on top and hoping for the best.
Jonathan mounted beside her. He did not ask any more questions about the window. He simply turned his horse south and said, Providence Road is that way. We'll make good time before the heat comes.
Good, Clara said. They rode out of Boston side by side in the early morning. The summer sky wide and pale above them, the road stretching ahead into open country, and behind them, the city where Silas Montgomery was at this moment reading a note from one of his men that said the woman had gotten away. Clara thought about that, and she felt not satisfaction exactly, but something that was its close cousin. Something that had teeth. They rode hard for the first hour without speaking. Then Jonathan pulled up slightly and said without looking at her, Your father, what was he like?
Clara was quiet for a moment.
Quiet, she said finally. Careful.
He laughed at things that weren't necessarily funny, like mathematical errors and spelling mistakes in official documents. He made terrible tea, and he didn't notice because he never actually tasted it. She paused. He believed that public records were the architecture of justice. That if the numbers were honest, the system could be honest. That the only thing preventing corruption from becoming permanent was someone willing to read the record all the way to the end. Jonathan said nothing for a moment. He sounds like a man who deserved better than what happened to him.
He does, Clara said. And he's going to get it.
They rode on. The road to Providence unfolded mile by mile, and Clara kept her father's ledger pressed against her side, and somewhere behind them, in a city, that had laughed at her dress and tried to send men to her door. Silas Montgomery was preparing his next move. He did not know that she was already three moves ahead. He had made the mistake that powerful men always made with women like Clara Whitmore. He had assumed that because she had nothing to lose. He was wrong. She had her father's truth, her own mind, and the particular fury of a woman who had been underestimated one time too many. She was not riding to Providence to find a box of papers. She was riding to close the final gap in a case that would end him, and she was going to ride every mile of that road without stopping until she had what she came for. They reached Providence late on the second day, road dusty and saddle sore, with the kind of silence between them that comes from 2 days of hard riding and not enough sleep and the constant low-grade awareness that someone might be following. No one had followed them. Clara had checked every crossroads, every tree line, every farmhouse they passed that sat too close to the road with its shutters half open. Nothing. Either Montgomery had not anticipated Providence, or he had not yet connected Thomas Mercer's name to the evidence chain. Either way, they had arrived ahead of whatever came next, and Clara intended to use every hour of that advantage. Ruth Mercer lived in a narrow rented house on the west side of Providence, 2 blocks from the river, in a neighborhood of working families and small tradespeople. A woman who took in sewing, according to the neighbor they asked. Quiet. Kept to herself. Had a young son, maybe 4 or 5 years old. Didn't talk about her father. That last detail was the one that stayed with Clara as she knocked on the door. People who didn't talk about dead family members were either grieving or afraid, sometimes both. Clara knew the feeling from the inside. The woman who opened the door was perhaps 22, with a plain face and watchful eyes and flour on her apron from what smelled like bread baking somewhere behind her. She looked at Clara, then at Jonathan standing a step back, and her expression went carefully neutral in the particular way of someone who had learned not to show reaction until they understood what they were dealing with. Ruth Mercer, Clara said. Who's asking? My name is Clara Whitmore. My father was Edmund Whitmore. He was the county clerk in Boston until 6 weeks ago when he died. Clara paused. I believe your father may have known him. Something moved across Ruth Mercer's face. It was brief and quickly controlled, but Clara caught it a flicker of recognition, and something underneath it that looked very much like fear. I don't know anything about county business, Ruth said. Her hand tightened on the doorframe. I'm not here about county business, Clara said quietly. I'm here because my father found something before he died, and it got him killed, and I believe your father may have found the same thing, and I believe the same people may have arranged what happened to him. She held Ruth's gaze steadily. I'm not here to cause you trouble. I'm here because the only way to stop these men from hurting anyone else is to finish what our fathers started. The silence stretched long enough to be uncomfortable. The sound of the child playing somewhere inside the house drifted through the gap in the door. Ruth Mercer looked at Jonathan. Who is he? Jonathan Ashford, Jonathan said. My family's estate was one of the properties defrauded in this scheme. I have legal standing to bring a formal complaint before the county court. Ruth's jaw tightened. She looked back at Clara. If I were to have anything, anything that might connect to what you're describing, what would you do with it? Use it to correct the official record, Clara said. Name the people responsible. Put the truth in a document that cannot be altered. She paused. And make sure that whatever your father knew and whatever he risked meant something.
Ruth Mercer stepped back from the door.
Come in, she said. But you wipe your boots first.
The wooden box was under the floorboard beneath the bedroom window. Ruth knew exactly where it was. She went to it without hesitating, without searching. Which told Clara that she had checked it recently, perhaps often. The box was plain pine latched, but not locked, and when Ruth set it on the table and opened it, the smell of old paper, and damp, and something faintly like candle wax rose from it into the small room. Inside were letters folded transfer receipts, a hand-drawn map of account routing, and a small notebook in a handwriting Clara did not recognize. Tight, fast, written by someone who was recording things quickly, perhaps afraid of being caught in the act of recording them. Clara sat down at the table and began reading. Thomas Mercer had been meticulous. He had documented every delivery he made between the county office and the Providence accounts. Dates, amounts, the names of the men who handed him the transfer orders, the names of the men who received them. He had written it all down in that small, tight hand, and then he had added his own notes in the margins, questions, inconsistencies. He had noticed things that troubled him enough to record. On page 11 of the notebook, he had written a single sentence with no context and no explanation, set apart from everything else by a line of empty space above and below it. The man who signs as Aldrich is a clerk named Harlan Webb. I have seen his signature on official documents. It is the same hand. Clara stopped breathing for a moment. Harlan Webb. She looked at Jonathan. He had gone very still. Do you know that name? She said. Harlan Webb has been Montgomery's personal legal secretary for 6 years, Jonathan said. His voice was flat and deliberate, the voice of a man being careful not to let anger get ahead of thought. He has authorization to sign transfer orders on Montgomery's behalf. He has full access to the county revenue accounts. Then he's the second signature, Clara said. He's the one who processed the transfers. He has to be the one who altered the entries he would have had access to the ledger books. She turned back to the notebook. Your father knew this, she said to Ruth. He identified Webb. He documented the connection. Ruth had not sat down. She was standing near the window, her arms crossed, watching Clara with an expression that was not quite fear anymore, but was not quite its absence either. My father came home 3 weeks before he died, and he told me he needed to make some records of things he'd been carrying, she said. He said it was a precaution. He said if anything ever happened to him, I should keep the box somewhere safe and not talk about it to anyone. She stopped. He died 2 weeks later. They said his horse threw him. Did his horse ever throw him before? Clara asked. Ruth said nothing, but her jaw said everything. Miss Mercer, Jonathan said carefully, we are going to take this to court. What's in this box combined with what we already have is enough to file a formal complaint. But a complaint alone won't survive Montgomery's political connections. We need witnesses. We need people who can testify that these documents are authentic. He looked at her steadily. Would you be willing to testify about where the box was kept, about what your father told you, about your own recognition of your father's handwriting? Ruth uncrossed her arms. She looked at her son, who had wandered in from the other room and was now sitting on the floor near the table playing with a wooden horse, completely unaware of what was happening above his head. He's 5 years old, Ruth said quietly. I've been taking in sewing for 3 years to keep us housed and fed. I have $17 to my name and a landlord who raises the rent every January. She looked at Clara. If I testify and Montgomery's people come after me, we will protect you, Clara said. Ruth looked at her with the particular expression of a woman who had been promised protection before by people who then left when the cost got high. How? Clara met her eyes. Because we have the same thing to lose. My father is already dead. Your father is already dead. The only thing left that matters is that what they found and what they paid for actually changes something. She leaned forward slightly. I am not leaving Providence without that box. And I am not walking into that courtroom without every piece of evidence we have. But I am also not asking you to do this alone. I will stand beside you in that courtroom, and so will Jonathan Ashford, and so will Margaret Bellamy, and your father's name will be in that official record right next to mine. Ruth Mercer looked at the box. She looked at her son. She pressed her lips together and breathed once steadily through her nose.
All right, she said. All right, but I need a week to arrange care for my boy. I won't leave him alone.
You have it, Clara said.
1 week.
They were back on the road to Boston within the hour the box secured in Clara's saddlebag, the notebook wrapped in oilskin alongside the ledger. The summer evening was cooling into a long gold dusk, and they rode for the first several miles without speaking. Both of them turning what they had found over in their minds, like stones being examined for their weight. Then Jonathan said, Harlan Webb.
Yes, Clara said.
He's been at Montgomery's side for 6 years. He attended every county revenue meeting for the last 4 years. He has the trust of every official in the administration. Jonathan's voice had that careful quality again, the controlled tension of a man holding anger at a precise distance. He's been inside this fraud from the beginning, and no one suspected him because Montgomery is the name everyone watches.
That's exactly why it worked, Clara said. Webb handles the mechanics. Montgomery provides the protection. Neither of them is exposed alone.
She thought for a moment.
We need Webb's employment record, the signature sample he filed when he was appointed. We need it to match against the Aldrich signatures in the transfer documents.
Margaret can get it, Jonathan said. She has connections in the county administration going back 30 years.
Then she needs to move fast, Clara said. Because when we get back to Boston and Montgomery realizes we went to Providence, he is going to understand what we found.
Jonathan looked at her sideways.
You think he'll run?
I think he'll fight, Clara said. Men like Montgomery don't run. They have too much invested in being exactly where they are. He'll file against us first if he can try to discredit the evidence before it reaches a judge. He'll use Webb to create counter documents. He'll attack my credibility and yours and Ruth's.
She paused.
He'll use the newspaper.
As if saying it aloud had given it permission to happen, they rounded a curve in the road and nearly collided with a rider coming hard from the opposite direction, a young man on a spotted horse who pulled up sharp, nearly unseating himself, and stared at them with wide eyes.
Mr. Ashford, he said breathlessly.
Sir, are you Jonathan Ashford?
I am, Jonathan said.
I've been sent from Mrs. Bellamy, sir. She's been sending riders down every road from Boston since yesterday morning.
The young man reached into his coat and produced a sealed letter. His hands were shaking slightly.
She said to find you no matter what it took. She said it was urgent.
Jonathan broke the seal and read the letter. Clara watched his face. His face told her everything before he spoke.
Montgomery filed yesterday afternoon, he said.
He beat us to the court. He's accused us of forgery, conspiracy, and theft of county property. He produced a witness, a man named Caldwell, who claims to have seen Clara's father altering entries in the county ledger himself.
Jonathan lowered the letter. His voice was even, but his eyes were not.
He's built the mirror case. He's made your father the criminal.
The words landed in Clara's chest like something physical.
She sat with them for a moment, breathing, feeling the weight and the cold and the particular awfulness of a man who would desecrate a dead man's name to save his own.
Who is Caldwell? She said.
Her voice came out steady. She was proud of that.
The letter doesn't say, Jonathan said.
Margaret says she's working on it.
He's purchased someone, Clara said, a false witness, someone who needed money or needed protection badly enough to put his name on a lie.
She straightened in the saddle.
We need to find out who Caldwell is and what Montgomery offered him. False witnesses make mistakes. They get details wrong. They say things that can be checked.
Clara.
Jonathan said her name without the formal prefix for the first time, and something about it, the directness of it, the absence of ceremony made her look at him sharply.
The judge assigned to the case is Harlan Wicks.
There it was. Montgomery's personal friend. The man who had dined at his table. The man who owed him professional courtesy, and perhaps more than courtesy.
Clara looked at the road ahead. The gold was fading from the sky now, the first edge of dark coming in from the east, and the road was empty and long, and she was tired in a way that went down into her back and her legs, and somewhere deeper than that. She thought about her father. She thought about Edmund Whitmore sitting in the records office at 7 in the morning, with a cold cup of tea and a column of numbers that did not add up, deciding to keep looking, even though the looking was dangerous.
deciding that the truth mattered more than the comfort of pretending not to see it. She thought about what he would say right now if he were sitting beside her on this road. He would tap his finger on the pommel of the saddle, and he would say, "Clara, girl." When a powerful man files first, it means he's afraid. Afraid men make mistakes. Find the mistake. "We need a different judge," she said. Jonathan looked at her. "Wickes won't recuse himself willingly." "Then we make it so he has to," Clara said. "We make the connection public. If Boston knows that Wickes has a personal relationship with Montgomery, if the newspaper prints it..." "The newspaper already printed something," Jonathan said. He glanced back at the letter. "Montgomery's version of events ran this morning. My name is in it, and yours." A pause. "They described you as a grief-stricken woman of unstable temperament who was manipulated by a wealthy opportunist." His jaw was tight. "That would be me, apparently." Clara looked at him. "Are you afraid of what people think of you?" He met her eyes. "Not even slightly." "Good," she said. "Because we are going to walk into Boston with everything we have, and we are going to give the other newspaper, the Gazette, not the Register. The Gazette has opposed Montgomery's political allies for 3 years. We are going to give them the whole story. Our version. With documentation." She thought fast. "Margaret can arrange the meeting. We need to be back in Boston by tomorrow evening." "That's a hard ride," Jonathan said. "I jumped out a second floor window yesterday morning," Clara said. "I think I can manage a hard ride." He almost smiled. It was brief and quickly controlled, but she saw it. They thanked the messenger and sent him back to Margaret with a note in Jonathan's hand. "We have what we went for. Back by tomorrow evening. Arrange meeting with Gazette. Also need Webb's employment signature file. J.A. Then they turned their horses north and rode. They stopped for 2 hours at a roadside inn when the horses needed water and rest, and Clara sat at a rough wooden table and ate bread and cold meat and went through Mercer's notebook page by lamplight, while Jonathan sat across from her and did not speak, which she found she appreciated. She had spent most of her life being alone with numbers and documents and the particular companionship of a problem that needed solving, and she was comfortable in that silence. She had not expected to be comfortable in it with another person present. She found that she was. At one point, Jonathan reached across the table and turned the notebook slightly so he could read the entry about Webb from where he sat. He read it twice. Then he said quietly, "My father was a good man. He trusted the system because he built his life on it, and the system was being robbed while he watched, and he never knew." Clara looked up from the page. "He'll know now," she said. "When the record is corrected, his name will be on it. Jonathan Ashford Sr., whose estate was defrauded. It will be in the official document permanently." Jonathan looked at her. Something in his face shifted, not quite gratitude, which would have been too simple, but something deeper and more complicated that she didn't have a name for. "You know," he said, "when Beatrice Montgomery told you that night that someone had forgotten to lock the kitchen entrance." "I remember," Clara said. "I was standing close enough to hear it," he said. "And I watched you not flinch." He paused. "I want you to know that I noticed that before I noticed anything else." Clara was quiet for a moment. "I flinched on the inside," she said honestly. "But you kept walking," he said. "Yes." "That's the part that matters," Jonathan said. And he said it simply without drama, the way a man states a thing he believes to be true. And Clara found she had no answer for it, so she looked back at the notebook and kept reading. They were back in the saddle before midnight. They rode through the dark with the stars overhead, and the road a gray ribbon, and the contents of Clara's saddlebag the most dangerous set of documents in the state of Massachusetts. And somewhere ahead of them, Boston was waiting with its courtrooms and its newspapers and its powerful men who had not yet understood that the woman they laughed at in the gray dress was coming back. She was coming back with a dead courier's notebook, a witness willing to testify, a legal partner with standing, and a case so thoroughly documented that the only way to defeat it would be to discredit every piece of evidence simultaneously, which was exactly the kind of task that powerful men attempted when they were afraid, and exactly the kind of task that collapsed when the evidence was solid enough.
Clara's evidence was solid enough. She had made sure of it. She pressed her heels to her horse's flanks and rode faster into the dark. And when dawn began to come up gray and pink over the eastern horizon, and the first shapes of Boston appeared in the distance, and Jonathan Ashford pulled up slightly beside her and said, "We made it." What Clara felt was not relief, it was readiness, because the hard part, the riding, the finding, the surviving was done. What came next was not survival. What came next was a courtroom and a newspaper and a false witness who had made a deal he didn't understand the cost of, and a judge who was about to discover that his friendship with Silas Montgomery had a public price. What came next was the part Clara had been preparing for since the night she opened her father's ledger and found the red ribbon on page 47. She was ready. She had always been ready. She just hadn't had the evidence to prove it until now. Margaret Bellamy was waiting for them at the back entrance of her house on Commonwealth Street. And she had not slept either, which Clara could see from 20 feet away in the gray morning light. The particular tightness around a person's eyes when sleep deprivation crosses the threshold from tired into something closer to wound up. She pulled them inside before they had finished tying the horses. "The Gazette meeting is arranged," she said, moving fast toward the back sitting room. 2 o'clock this afternoon. The editor is a man named Samuel Fitch. He's been wanting a reason to run against Montgomery's circle for 2 years. I told him we had documentation. He nearly came through the wall with excitement. She shut the door behind them. "Now tell me what you found." "You." Clara set the saddlebag on the table and opened it. She laid out Mercer's notebook, the transfer receipts, the hand-drawn account routing map, and the folded letters, and she talked while she did it efficiently and without repetition, the way her father had taught her to present evidence facts. First implications, second conclusions, last. Margaret listened without interrupting, which Clara respected enormously. When Clara finished, Margaret picked up the notebook and turned to the page with Harlan Webb's name on it. She read it once. She set it down. "I have the signature file," she said. She went to the desk in the corner and returned with a folded paper. "I told you I had a connection in the county administration. His name is George Pell. He has worked in the appointments office for 19 years, and he owes Edmund Whitmore a debt that he's been carrying for a long time. Edmund helped his son avoid a false prosecution 8 years ago. George pulled Webb's employment record last night after everyone else had gone home." She unfolded the paper and laid it beside the transfer documents with the Aldrich signatures. Clara leaned over the table. She looked at the two sets of handwriting for perhaps 15 seconds. "It's the same," she said. "Look at the capital H, and the way the W loops back on itself. This is not a similarity, this is the same hand." Jonathan came around the table and looked. "Agreed," he said. "That is your inside man," Margaret said. "That is the man who processed every fraudulent transfer, who altered every entry, who signed every false authorization. Without Webb, Montgomery couldn't have moved a single dollar." She paused. "And Webb is currently sitting in Montgomery's house on Beacon Hill, which I know because I had someone watch the address last night." "He hasn't run," Jonathan said. "He doesn't know we have the notebook," Clara said. "He doesn't know Mercer documented him by name. As far as Webb is concerned, we have the ledger and the suspicion, but not the proof of his specific role." She straightened. "We need to keep it that way until we're in front of a judge." "About that," Margaret said. Her voice changed slightly, not in volume, but in quality, the way a voice changes when it's carrying something heavy. "Wickes has set a preliminary hearing for Monday, 3 days from now. He's moving faster than he should, which tells me Montgomery has asked him to." "Moving fast to do what?" Jonathan asked. "To issue a restraining order, preventing Clara from accessing county records or presenting the ledger as evidence on the grounds that it constitutes stolen county property," Margaret said. "If Wickes issues that order before we can present the counterclaim, our primary evidence is legally inadmissible." The room went quiet. Clara understood immediately what that meant. If the ledger was declared stolen property, everything that flowed from it, every cross-reference, every comparison, every conclusion she had drawn, became tainted.
The case didn't collapse, but it lost its spine. A case without its spine could still stand, if everything else was strong enough. But strong enough was not the same as certain, and certain was what she needed.
Then we go to the Gazette today, and we make the Wiki's connection public before Monday, Clara said. If Boston knows that the judge on this case has dined at Montgomery's table, Wiki's cannot issue that order without the entire city understanding exactly what he is.
Public pressure alone won't force a recusal, Jonathan said.
No, Clara agreed. But there's someone who can, who is the senior judge on the Massachusetts Circuit Court.
Margaret looked at her. William Hartley. He's been on the circuit for 30 years.
Does he have any connection to Montgomery?
None that I know of, Margaret said. Hartley is an old line man, deeply conservative about the appearance of judicial neutrality. He once removed a colleague from a civil case for accepting a gift worth less than $5 from a litigant.
Then we go to Hartley directly, Clara said, not through a petition, not through the formal complaint process that takes weeks. We go to him personally today before the Gazette meeting if possible. We present the documentation of Wiki's relationship with Montgomery, and we ask him to review the case assignment.
She looked at Margaret.
Can you arrange access to Hartley?
Margaret was quiet for a moment.
His wife is Catherine Hartley, she said slowly. She and I have been in the same charitable society for 11 years. She paused. I have never once used that friendship for anything except the charitable work it was meant for.
I know, Clara said quietly, and I'm sorry to ask.
Margaret looked at her. Then she straightened, and something in her bearing shifted the particular shift of a woman who has made a decision and moved past the cost of making it.
Edmund Whitmore sat in that records office for 11 years doing honest work, she said. Catherine Hartley will understand the importance of that. I'll send a note within the hour.
They split into three directions. Margaret went to write the note to Catherine Hartley. Jonathan went to arrange a meeting with the Gazette's editor, confirming the time and preparing a summary document of the evidence that could be shared without releasing the original materials. Clara went upstairs to the room Margaret had prepared, where she washed her face, changed into the clean dress she had packed, and sat on the edge of the bed for exactly 10 minutes. She allowed herself 10 minutes. She used them to feel every difficult thing she had been holding at a careful distance for the past 3 days. The fear she had not let herself feel when the men came to her boarding room door. The grief she had not let herself feel when she held her father's notebook in her hands. In Ruth Mercer's small house, the anger she had not let herself feel when Margaret told her Montgomery had filed first and put her father's name on a lie. She felt all of it in those 10 minutes, let it move through her, the way a storm moves through fast and complete, and then done. Then she stood up, pinned her hair, picked up the saddlebag, and went back downstairs. By 11 o'clock that morning, Margaret had a response from Catherine Hartley. Judge Hartley would receive them at 12:30. He would give them 30 minutes. Clara and Jonathan arrived at Hartley's private office exactly on time. The judge was 70 years old with white hair and the kind of face that had been stern for so long, it had settled into sternness permanently. He did not rise when they entered. He looked at Clara with the assessing look of a man who had spent 30 years deciding whether people in front of him were telling the truth.
Mrs. Bellamy vouches for you, he said. That is the only reason you are standing in this room. You have 30 minutes. Use them.
Clara opened the saddlebag. She laid the documents on his desk in order. She spoke for 22 minutes without stopping clearly and precisely, and she did not use a single word she did not need. When she reached the section on Wicks and Montgomery's social relationship, she laid the newspaper records of their public appearances together alongside the Gazette piece from 3 years ago, noting their close political alignment.
Hartley looked at the documents. He looked at Clara. He said nothing for a long moment. Then he said, "The Aldrich signatures and the Webb employment record. You've had these independently compared."
"I have compared them myself," Clara said. "And Mr. Ashford has confirmed my assessment. We can submit them to any independent examiner the court designates."
"The Providence materials. The notebook. You're prepared to establish chain of custody. Ruth Mercer will testify to where the box was kept, who placed it there, and the circumstances under which it was preserved," Clara said. "Her father's handwriting is identifiable and verifiable."
Hartley looked at Jonathan.
Mr. Ashford, your family's financial loss as a result of this alleged fraud. You can document that with estate records.
Comprehensively, Jonathan said. I have 8 years of estate accounts that show the discrepancy between projected and actual tenant revenue from the eastern parcels.
Hartley folded his hands on his desk. He sat for a moment that felt considerably longer than it was.
I am going to review the case assignment, he said. I will make no determination today. I am going to examine this documentation, and I am going to examine Judge Wicks's case history for any pattern of partial conduct.
He looked at Clara directly.
I want to be clear with you, Miss Whitmore. This review does not guarantee a recusal. It does not guarantee anything, except that I will look at what you have brought me with the seriousness it appears to warrant.
That is all I'm asking, Clara said.
Good, Hartley said.
Because it is all I'm offering.
He stood, which was clearly the signal that the 30 minutes were up.
One more thing. The evidence you have presented here today, none of it leaves this room in any public form until I have completed my review. No newspaper, no public statement. If I find you have released this material publicly before I have had the opportunity to assess it, I will view that as an attempt to influence my review, and I will take a dim view of that.
Clara and Jonathan exchanged a look.
How long will the review take? Jonathan asked.
48 hours, Hartley said. You will have my decision by Saturday morning.
They walked out of Hartley's office and into the street, and Clara stopped on the front step and breathed.
The Gazette, Jonathan said carefully. We were meant to meet Fitch at 2 o'clock.
I know, Clara said.
We can't.
If we cancel and Hartley takes longer than 48 hours.
He won't, Clara said.
Hartley is a man who said 48 hours and meant 48 hours.
I could see it.
She looked at Jonathan.
We have to trust the process we set in motion. If we go around it now, we risk everything.
Jonathan looked at her for a moment.
All right, he said. I'll send word to Fitch. Ask him to hold.
Tell him we'll have more for him by Saturday, Clara said.
Tell him it will be worth the wait.
The next 48 hours were the hardest of the entire ordeal, which was saying something considerable given that the ordeal had included jumping out a second-floor window and riding through the night.
Waiting was its own kind of difficulty, the particular agony of having done everything possible and then being required to be still while other people made decisions.
Clara spent Friday at Margaret's house going through every document again, finding every possible weakness, and preparing answers for every question she could anticipate a hostile lawyer raising.
Jonathan worked beside her for most of it, and she found his presence useful in a specific way. He thought like a legal opponent, finding the angles and the counter-arguments, pushing back on her reasoning, until she had strengthened it past the point where it could be easily challenged.
On Friday evening, Ruth Mercer arrived from Providence with her son and a single trunk of belongings. She was pale and tired, and held her boy's hand with the grip of a woman who had spent 2 days being afraid and had decided to come anyway.
Clara met her at the door.
You came, Clara said.
I told you I would, Ruth said, simply as if there had never been any question.
Clara showed her upstairs to the room Margaret had prepared. She brought her tea. She sat with her for an hour while the boy fell asleep in the corner, and they talked not about the case, but about their fathers. About what it felt like to be the daughter of a man who had done a quiet, honest thing in a corrupt world, and paid for it with his life.
It was the first conversation Clara had allowed herself that was not about evidence or strategy, and she felt it settle something in her chest that had been tight for 6 weeks.
Saturday morning arrived with the kind of sharp summer clarity that made everything feel very immediate and very real.
The message from Hartley came at 9 o'clock. It was brief and formal, and it said three things. First, he had reviewed the documentation and found the evidence of Wick's relationship with Montgomery sufficient to raise a serious question of impartiality. Second, he had spoken with Wicks privately, and Wicks had agreed under pressure that the message described only as significant to recuse himself from the case. Third, Hartley himself would preside over the hearing, which was rescheduled for the following Wednesday.
Clara read the message standing in Margaret's hallway. She read it twice,
Then she folded it carefully and put it in her coat pocket beside her father's journal. Jonathan was watching her from the doorway.
"Well," he said.
"Wiki's is out," she said. "Hartley is in. Wednesday."
Jonathan let out a breath. It was the first time she had seen him do anything that looked like relief, and it lasted approximately 1 second before his expression settled back into focus.
"Then we have 4 days to prepare."
"Yes," Clara said. "Starting with the Gazette. We can publish now. The recusal is public record."
She looked at him.
"I want the story out before Montgomery has time to find another angle."
"I'll contact Fitch this morning," Jonathan said.
By Saturday afternoon, the story was in Samuel Fitch's hands, and by Saturday evening, Fitch had confirmed it would run in Monday's edition with full documentation. By Sunday, half of Boston had heard about it through the social channels that moved faster than any newspaper. The conversations at church, the whispers at market, the quiet talk over back fences between neighbors, who were only now beginning to understand that the county's finances had been a fiction for nearly a decade. Monday morning, the Gazette ran the story across its front page. It named Montgomery. It named Webb. It named the Harwick Land Trust. It reproduced the key figures from the evidence chain, not the original documents, but a clear summary that any literate person could follow. It noted the recusal of Judge Wicks and mentioned his social relationship with Montgomery without editorial comment, which was somehow more devastating than editorial comment would have been. Clara read the paper at Margaret's kitchen table at 6 in the morning. She read the whole piece carefully, including the last paragraph, which said, "The original discrepancy in the county revenue records was first identified by Edmund Whitmore, county clerk, who served in that position for 11 years prior to his death in June of this year. Mr. Whitmore's daughter, Clara Whitmore, has spent 6 weeks completing the investigation her father began." She put the paper down. She pressed her hands flat on the table. She stared at her father's name in print. Not on a death notice. Not on a burial record. But on a story about something he had found, and something he had known, and something that was because of him now coming to light. She did not cry. She had already used her 10 minutes. But she sat with it for a long moment, just her and his name, and the morning light coming through the window, and she let it mean what it meant. Then Margaret appeared in the doorway with 2 cups of tea, and behind her came Jonathan, who had clearly also been up since before dawn. And Ruth Mercer's boy toddled in behind him, carrying a wooden horse, and demanding breakfast, in the imperious way of 5-year-olds, who have not yet learned to be careful about what they ask for. The kitchen filled with the ordinary noise of people who had gotten through something hard together and were now briefly on the other side of it. Outside, Monday was beginning. The city was waking up. And somewhere across Boston, in a house on Beacon Hill, Silas Montgomery was reading the Gazette and understanding, perhaps for the first time, that the woman in the gray dress had not been a problem he could make disappear. She had been the beginning of his ending, and Wednesday was 4 days away. Wednesday came in fast and hard, the way summer storms came, with the kind of still heavy air that made everything feel like it was holding its breath. Clara was dressed and downstairs at 5 in the morning. She had the documents organized in 3 separate folders, each one wrapped in oilskin and labeled in her own hand. She had her copy of the evidence chain, the original ledger in its oilskin binding, Mercer's notebook, the signature comparison, and Ruth's written statement, which Ruth had spent Sunday evening composing at Margaret's kitchen table with Clara sitting beside her, not directing her, just present the way you sit beside someone who is doing something hard and needs to know they are not alone in it. Margaret came downstairs at 5:30 and put bread and cold meat on the table and said, "Eat." Clara ate. Ruth came down at 6 with her boy asleep against her shoulder, and Jonathan arrived at the back door at 6:30 with a face that said he had also not slept and also was not going to mention it. "Montgomery's lawyer filed a motion yesterday evening to delay the hearing," Jonathan said without preamble. "Hartley denied it at 9 o'clock last night. I had a note from Hartley's clerk an hour ago." "Of course he denied it," Clara said. "He's not a man who changes his mind twice." "Montgomery also withdrew Caldwell," Jonathan said. "The false witness, he pulled him entirely."
Clara looked up from her bread.
Why?
Because we found Caldwell, Jonathan said. There was something in his voice now not quite satisfaction, but its close cousin. His real name is James Farrow. He's a debt collector from Charlestown, who has done work for Montgomery's companies before. Once we identified him through the employment records and the Gazette ran his description, without naming him, someone recognized him and sent word to Margaret. He paused. When Farrow understood that we knew who he was and that he was going to be cross-examined under oath about his testimony, he apparently decided that the money Montgomery paid him was not worth a perjury conviction.
So Montgomery lost his witness, Clara said.
And he knows we know about Webb, Jonathan said. Which means his entire case just collapsed from the inside. Clara was quiet for a moment.
He's going to try something else this morning, she said.
In the courtroom. He still has his lawyer, and he still has money, and he still has the instinct of a man who has never lost a fight in a public room. He will try something.
I know, Jonathan said.
What do we do?
We walk in ready, Clara said, and we don't give him any space to find one.
The Boston County Courthouse was 3 blocks from the common, and by the time Clara and Jonathan arrived at 8:30, there were people outside it. Not a crowd exactly, but more than you would expect for a Wednesday morning. Hearing a dozen men from the trades, several women in plain working dress, a cluster of older men who looked like they had spent years dealing with county offices and found the subject of land fraud personally relevant. The Gazette story had done what Clara hoped it would do. It had made the thing real to people who had names attached to the accounts and families attached to the land. One of the older men caught Clara's eye as she came up the steps. He was perhaps 60 with a farmer's hands and a town coat that was too formal for him. The kind of coat a man put on when he wanted to be taken seriously in a place where his ordinary work clothes would not serve him. He looked at her, and he nodded once slowly the way men nod when they want to communicate respect without making a production of it. Clara nodded back. She kept walking. Inside the courtroom filled steadily. Montgomery was already present, seated at the respondent's table, with his lawyer, a man named Charles Vane, who had argued successfully in 6 of the last 8 cases he had brought before Massachusetts courts. Montgomery himself was dressed carefully. Dark coat, white cravat, the silver hair combed back with the kind of precision that communicated control. He looked like a man who was confident in the architecture of his own respectability. He did not look at Clara when she entered, which told her everything about how afraid he was. Harlan Webb was not present. Clara noted that immediately. She leaned close to Jonathan and said so.
He may have been advised not to attend, Jonathan said quietly.
If Montgomery's lawyer is trying to create distance between Montgomery and Webb, keeping Webb out of the room is part of that strategy.
Then we need Webb on record, Clara said.
I want Hartley to formally request his presence.
I'll pass that to our counsel, Jonathan said.
Their counsel was a man named Edward Marsh, 60 years old with a gray beard and the manner of a man who had seen a great many courtrooms and found them considerably less impressive than people supposed. Jonathan had retained him Monday morning. Marsh had spent Monday afternoon and Tuesday reading every document Clara had organized, and he had said at the end of Tuesday, leaning back in his chair and looking at the ceiling, "Miss Whitmore, in 40 years of practice, I have seen perhaps 3 cases where the evidence was this complete. Your father was a thorough man." Clara had said, "He was," and had not trusted herself to say anything else. Marsh now sat beside them at the plaintiff's table, and when Clara passed him a note about Webb, he read it, nodded without expression, and wrote something on his own paper. Judge Hartley entered at 9 o'clock precisely. The room stood and sat. Hartley looked out over the courtroom with the expression of a man conducting an inventory, settled his eyes briefly on Clara, briefly on Montgomery, and then looked at the papers in front of him. "We are here on the matter of the formal complaint filed by Jonathan Ashford against Silas Montgomery regarding alleged fraudulent alteration of county land revenue records," Hartley said, "and on the counter-complaint filed by Montgomery against Miss Clara Whitmore and Mr. Ashford alleging forgery and theft of county property." He looked up.
"Mr. Vane,
Before we proceed, I want to address the matter of your client's witness withdrawal. Vane rose. He was smooth and practiced and completely composed.
Your Honor, my client withdrew the witness statement as a matter of caution, having reviewed the testimony and determined it did not meet the standard of certainty appropriate for.
Call Mr. Vane, Hartley said without particular heat.
The word I am looking for is insufficient. Your client's witness was insufficient. We will proceed on that understanding.
He looked at Marsh.
Mr. Marsh, you have requested the presence of Harlan Webb in these proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor, Marsh said.
Mr. Webb's role in the alleged fraud is documented in the evidence we intend to present today. His testimony is material.
Mr. Vane, Hartley said.
Vane hesitated for a fraction of a second, so brief that most people in the room would not have caught it, but Clara caught it.
Your Honor, Mr. Webb is not a party to these proceedings.
No, Hartley said.
He is a material witness.
There is a difference. I am ordering Mr. Webb to appear before this court by 2 o'clock this afternoon. We will recess at noon and resume at 2. If Mr. Webb does not appear, I will issue a warrant.
He did not wait for Vane's response.
Mr. Marsh, present your case.
What followed was 3 hours that Clara would remember for the rest of her life in specific granular detail, not as a blur, not as an emotional storm, but as a sequence of moments, each one sharply distinct from the one before it.
Marsh walked Hartley through the evidence in the order Clara had constructed it, and Clara watched the judge's face while he did. Hartley was not a demonstrative man. He did not react visibly when Marsh laid the altered ledger pages before him, or when he presented the Harwick Land Trust registration documents with Montgomery's initials, or when he walked through the 8 years of Ashford Estate revenue discrepancy. But his pen moved. He wrote notes consistently and quickly, which was the sign of a man who was building a picture in his own mind and finding that the pieces fit.
Then Marsh called Clara to testify. She walked to the witness chair and sat down and looked at Hartley directly. She was aware of the room, the people in the gallery, Montgomery at his table. Jonathan watching from the plaintiff's table with his jaw set and his eyes steady. But she let all of it recede to the periphery, the way her father had taught her to let everything recede except the numbers when you were looking at a column that didn't add up. The only thing that mattered was the truth and the precise language required to carry it accurately into the record.
Marsh led her through the evidence chain from the beginning. She testified for 40 minutes. She was clear and specific and completely calm, and every time Marsh asked her to explain a figure or an entry, she explained it in language plain enough that anyone in the room could follow it without legal training. When Marsh finished, Vane rose for cross-examination. He tried 3 angles. He suggested her grief had compromised her objectivity.
Clara said, "My grief is personal. These numbers are not. They are county records and they either add up or they don't. They don't."
He suggested she lacked the professional credentials to interpret county revenue records.
Clara said, "My father taught me to read these records when I was 11 years old. I have spent 12 years reading them. I am more qualified than anyone currently in this room to interpret them, including the county officials who failed to notice they had been altered."
A sound moved through the gallery, not quite a laugh, but something adjacent to it. Vane tried a 3rd angle, suggesting the ledger had been removed from the records office improperly. Marsh objected. Hartley sustained it and said calmly,
"Mr. Vane, the chain of custody for that ledger has been thoroughly established. Move on."
Vane sat down. He had found nothing. Clara returned to the plaintiff's table. Jonathan looked at her briefly, not with the elaborate admiration of a man performing approval, but with the simple directness of a man who had watched something difficult done well and recognized it for what it was. That look meant more to her than any elaborate statement would have. At noon, Hartley called the recess. During the recess, something happened that no one had planned for. Beatrice Montgomery found Clara in the corridor outside the courtroom. Clara saw her coming and braced herself, not physically, but in the particular way you brace your mind when you see something complicated approaching. Beatrice looked different. Not in her clothes or her hair or anything external. Something internal had shifted. She looked like a woman who had been carrying a weight,
and was not certain whether she was about to set it down or whether it would simply fall.
"Miss Whitmore," she said.
She stopped a few feet away and did not extend her hand.
"Miss Montgomery,"
Clara said carefully.
"I want to say something," Beatrice said. "I may not have another opportunity."
She paused, and Clara could see the effort the pause cost her, the practice composure warring with something that appeared unexpectedly to be genuine. "The story they told about your father, the fever. I knew when I heard it that it was not the right shape for the truth. I did not say so because..." She stopped again. "Because saying so would have required me to ask questions about my own father that I was not prepared to ask." Clara said nothing. She waited.
"I was cruel to you at the ball," Beatrice said.
"That was not about you. It was about I had been trained for so long to protect my family's position that I could not stop doing it even when it was wrong." She looked at Clara directly.
"I am not asking for your forgiveness. I don't think that's the appropriate thing to ask for."
She paused. "I only wanted you to know that I know." Clara looked at her for a long moment.
"What does your own conscience tell you to do?" she asked.
Beatrice blinked. It was clear the question surprised her.
"I don't know."
"Yes, you do," Clara said, not unkindly. "You've known it for a while. That's what you came to tell me." She held Beatrice's gaze steadily.
"This courtroom is still in session this afternoon. What you do with what you know is your own decision, Miss Montgomery. But you'll have to live with it either way."
She walked back toward the courtroom without waiting for an answer. What happened at 2 o'clock was the twist no one saw coming, least of all Silas Montgomery. Harlan Webb walked into the courtroom at 1:58, 2 minutes before the deadline, and he did not come alone. He came with a lawyer. Clara had never seen a younger man who looked like he had been retained in the last 24 hours. And he came with something else, a sealed envelope, that his lawyer handed directly to Hartley's clerk the moment they entered. Hartley opened the envelope. He read whatever was inside it. His expression did not change, but his pen stopped moving, which was the closest thing to visible reaction Clara had seen from him all day.
"Mr. Webb," Hartley said, "I understand you wish to make a statement before providing testimony."
"Yes, Your Honor," Webb said.
His voice was thin and tightly controlled. He was perhaps 45 with a forgettable face and the hands of a man who worked at a desk, and he looked like someone who had spent 48 hours making a very difficult calculation and had finally arrived at a conclusion he did not like but could not argue with.
"Your statement indicates that you wish to provide full testimony in cooperation with this court," Hartley said,
"in exchange for consideration regarding your own exposure in this matter."
"Yes, Your Honor," Webb said.
The courtroom went very still. At the respondent's table, Montgomery turned and looked at Webb. It was a brief look, completely controlled, and it communicated nothing that a stranger would be able to read. But Clara was not a stranger to what documents looked like when someone had altered them to say something other than the truth, and she understood the look for exactly what it was. Webb did not look back. He took the witness chair. He was sworn. And then in the careful, flat voice of a man who had decided that the only remaining form of self-preservation available to him was the truth, Harlan Webb told everything. He told how Montgomery had approached him 7 years ago with an arrangement that was framed as administrative convenience, small adjustments to revenue reporting, minor reclassifications of accounts. He told how the adjustments had grown larger over time and the reclassifications more complex, until he understood that what he was doing was fraud, and understood also that he was already too far in to walk away without consequences. He told how the shell accounts had been constructed, how the Harwick Land Trust had operated as the collection point, how the revenue had been moved through Providence, and then into private accounts held under Montgomery's family name through a proxy arrangement. He told how Thomas Mercer had made the deliveries, and how he had come to believe Mercer had begun keeping records, and how he had told Montgomery, and how Montgomery had said calmly and without apparent distress, "That will be handled." When he said those words, "that will be handled," the courtroom made a sound that was not quite sound, more like a collective inhalation, a room full of people arriving at the same understanding simultaneously. Ruth Mercer, sitting in the gallery, reached down and took her son's hand.
Vane attempted to interrupt twice. Hartley stopped him both times with a single flat word, "No."
Webb testified for 45 minutes. By the time he finished, the counter-complaint against Clara and Jonathan had effectively disintegrated. Webb had confirmed the ledger was in legitimate custody. Confirmed Clara's analysis of the altered entries was accurate. Confirmed the shell names and the routing and the false signatures. He had handed the court the interior of the fraud from the inside. Hartley called a brief recess. He returned and delivered his initial findings in 20 minutes, which was extraordinary speed for a man of his deliberate temperament, but which reflected Clara understood the fact that by this point, the evidence was not ambiguous. The official record would show that county land revenue records had been deliberately and systematically altered. That the Harwick Land Trust was an instrument of fraud. That the Ashford Estate and 14 other properties had been defrauded of revenue totaling, by preliminary estimate, more than $60,000 over 8 years. That Edmund Whitmore County Clerk was the first person to formally identify and document the fraudulent alterations. That his identification was correct. Clara heard her father's name in Hartley's voice, and she sat completely still and let it land. The criminal referral for Montgomery was issued before the session closed. Webb's cooperation agreement would be addressed separately. Hartley also noted, without elaborating, that the matter of Judge Wicks's recusal would be subject to a separate administrative review, which everyone in the room understood to mean that Wicks's conduct was going to be examined at a level beyond the current proceedings. Montgomery was escorted from the courtroom by two county officers. He walked with his back straight and his face controlled, and he did not look at Clara as he passed. She did not require him to. Outside the courthouse in the warm summer afternoon, Boston was doing what Boston did. Moving, talking, carrying on with the business of a city that did not stop for individual reckonings. But the people who had gathered outside the building that morning were still there. The men with farmers' hands and working women in plain dresses and older citizens who understood what county land records meant to a family that depended on the land. And when Clara came down the steps, the man who had nodded at her that morning nodded again. This time, several people around him did the same. Ruth Mercer appeared beside Clara on the steps, her boy balanced on her hip. "It's done," she said. "The first part is done," Clara said. "The criminal process will take longer. But the record is corrected. Your father's name is in that document." Ruth pressed her lips together. She looked up at the sky for a moment. Then she looked back at Clara and said, "He would have been glad of that." "So would mine," Clara said. Jonathan came to stand beside her. He did not say anything for a moment. The afternoon light was bright and direct, and somewhere down the street, a horse-drawn cart was making the particular noise of iron wheels on cobblestone that Clara had heard every day of her life in Boston, and had always found in some irrational way comforting. "I want to offer you something," Jonathan said, formally. He turned to face her. "The Ashford Estate is going to require years of work to properly reconstruct its financial records and rebuild what was taken. I need someone who can read the accounts the way your father could, the way you can." He paused. "I am asking if you would be willing to take on that work, as a paid professional engagement, your own office, your own terms, your own authority over the accounting process." Clara looked at him. "That is a formal offer." "It is," he said. "No obligation attached. If you have other plans, I'll respect that completely." He held her gaze steadily. "But I don't want to make a decision about who rebuilds this estate without asking the person most qualified to do it." Clara thought about it for exactly the time it deserved, which was not long. She had spent 6 weeks running on grief and urgency and the particular focused energy of a person with a mission they cannot set down. She had not thought beyond the mission. She had not let herself. But standing here now with the mission accomplished and the city moving around her and Jonathan Ashford, waiting for her answer with the careful respect of a man who had learned in the past 2 weeks what it looked like when someone was genuinely competent and had adjusted his understanding of the world accordingly, she thought about her father's ledger on a shelf. She thought about an office. She thought about work that mattered being done honestly by someone who knew how to do it. "Yes," she said. "On my terms." "On your terms," he agreed. 3 months later, Clara Whitmore had an office on the second floor of the Ashford Estate's main house,
with a window that looked east and a shelf that held her father's ledger beside her own expanding set of account books. The federal investigation that Hartley had quietly initiated had expanded into 4 additional counties and identified a network of land fraud operations that had been running in various forms for more than a decade. Montgomery's trial was proceeding through the courts with the slow inevitability of a process that had the evidence it needed and knew it. Harlan Webb had provided testimony in 3 separate proceedings. Judge Wicks had quietly resigned from the bench. Ruth Mercer had moved to Boston. Margaret Bellamy had helped her find a position with a seamstress of good reputation on the North Side, and Ruth's boy had found his footing in the city with the adaptability of small children who do not yet understand they were supposed to be afraid of change. On a Saturday morning in late September, Clara walked to the cemetery on the east side of the city where her father was buried. She brought no flowers. She brought the Gazette folded to the page that carried the final summary of the court's initial findings, with Edmund Whitmore's name in the 3rd paragraph correctly and permanently attributed as the first person to identify and document the fraud. She stood at the grave, and she read that paragraph aloud, because he had taught her that the truth deserved to be spoken, not just written. "You were right, Papa," she said quietly. "When a number lies, it lies somewhere you're not supposed to look. That's how you find it." She stood there for a while in the September morning with the light coming through the trees and the city going about its business on the other side of the cemetery wall. And she felt not complete exactly, because grief doesn't arrive at completion. It only arrives at a place where you can carry it without it carrying you. She felt that something had been restored. Not to the way it was before. That was not possible, and she had never expected it to be. But restored to the truth. Set straight in the record. Her father's name where it belonged. When she left the cemetery, Jonathan was waiting outside the gate with 2 horses, because she had mentioned that morning that she wanted to ride out to the eastern parcels to check the lease records in person. And he had said he would come. And that was what they did. Now worked alongside each other with the ease of 2 people who had come to trust each other in conditions that tested trust completely and had found it held. He didn't say anything when she came through the gate. He simply handed her the reins of her horse. She took them, and they rode east out of the city together into the wide September morning, and the road ahead of them was open and long, and entirely their own to determine. Clara Whitmore had walked into a ballroom in a gray dress carrying a dead man's ledger, and they had laughed at her, and she had kept walking, and she had not stopped walking, until the truth was in the official record where it belonged. Her father's name was restored. The men who stole from families across 4 counties were facing justice, and the room that had been built to keep her out had been changed permanently by the fact that she had entered it. She carried the ledger and the truth and her father's name forward, and she never waited to be invited again.